Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in the last part of the last chapter of the book of Leviticus, Leviticus 27, verses 26 through 34. I will entitle this section, Restrictions on Redemption Rights. Our context is this: in the first part of chapter 27 and the last audio, in verses 1 through 25, we looked at the redemption of people, animals, houses, and fields. Now, this last chapter is somewhat technical, but we're almost through with it, and there's only 9 verses to deal with in this section. So let's begin Leviticus 27, verses 26 through 27. However, a firstborn among animals, which as a firstborn belongs to the Lord, no man may consecrate it, whether ox or sheep, it is the Lord's. But if it is among the unclean animals, then he shall redeem it according to your valuation and add to it 1/5 of it. And if it is not redeemed, then it shall be sold according to your valuation. The your there, of course, is referring to Moses, because God's still speaking to Moses, and Moses stands for the, he's going to pass it on to Aaron, who's in charge of all the priesthood. So Moses is in charge of all this, so that's what it means by your valuation. Now, verse 26 talks about the firstborn. The firstborn was dedicated to the Lord. It belonged to God automatically. We read in Exodus 13:2 this: Sanctify to me every firstborn, the first offspring of every womb among the sons of Israel, both of man and beast. It belongs to me. So, why could you not consecrate or give for sacrifice to the priest? Why could you not give a firstborn? Very simple. Because you're giving something that doesn't belong to you. I couldn't steal something from you and then give it to the priest, could I? Well, if you take the firstborn, you're stealing it from God and giving it to the priest, which, of course, is a no-no. You can't do it. Now, this firstborn is talking about firstborn of clean animals, herd in the flock, cows, lamb, and goats, because that's the kind of animals that were sacrificed. We can prove that, more or less. I think it's sort of obvious, but we could prove it by looking at Exodus 13:12. You shall devote to the Lord the first offspring of every womb and the first offspring of every beast that you own. The males belong to the Lord. That's the general command to sacrifice the firstborn. And then in chapter 34, verse 19 of Exodus, we read this: The first offspring from every womb belongs to me, and all your male livestock. The first offspring from, and this, these are the important words, from cattle and sheep. So the firstborn was talking about cattle and sheep. They're clean. But then you drop down to the next verse after Exodus 34:19, and we get a reference to unclean animals. You shall redeem with a lamb the first offspring from a donkey. And if you do not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. So the rule of the first offspring, the firstborn belonging to God, was only referring to either people or clean animals. It was not referring to unclean animals like donkeys. And we'll extrapolate from donkeys to any unclean animal, like as a camel or anything. So if you have a firstborn donkey, you have to take a lamb to substitute for the donkey and give the lamb to the priest. And then he will do what he does with it. Sacrifice it, pour the blood in front of the altar, probably, and then put the fat on the altar for God's part. Then he and the Levites are going to eat the rest. That's generally what's done, although it doesn't actually say that for the firstborn. Now, if you don't give that lamb to the priest, then you have to break the donkey's neck. In other words, you're not going to give the firstborn donkey to the priest. I guess the donkey, priest can't use the donkey. You think he could sell it, maybe. But no, you either redeem it with a lamb or you break the donkey's neck so you don't get any use out of it. This, of course, would encourage gifts of lambs to the priest, which the priest could use to sacrifice and then eat the flesh of as a part of their support. Now, notice here, as Matthew Poole points out, there's no 20% penalty, no 20% extra to the valuation. Well, there's no valuation of the donkey, actually. You redeem it with a lamb, and or you break the donkey's neck. There's no 20% involved here. So that's how you deal with an unclean firstborn. Or at least an unclean firstborn donkey. That's what Exodus 34:20 is about. We have a problem with reconciling that with Leviticus 27:27, our verse here, because Leviticus 27:27 allows for the redemption of unclean animals. I'm assuming that it's unclean firstborns. That's an assumption. The verse doesn't actually say that, but the previous verse is about unclean firstborn, so I'd assume verse 27 is too. But now the problem is how do you handle the fact that Leviticus 27 allows for redemption, whereas Exodus 34, for an unclean firstborn donkey, you can't redeem it. You have to, well, you could redeem it, but not by valuing it with 20%. You have to give a lamb to the priest instead of valuing the donkey. Well, here's a couple of ways you can reconcile that. You could say that Leviticus 27:27 is for unclean firstborns in general, whereas Exodus 34:20 is for donkeys only, special case. Why there would be a special case? I don't know why. Why can't you value a donkey like you value a lamb? I don't think that's the right answer, but that is one way you could reconcile it. Another way you could say is Leviticus 27:27 is for unclean animals in general, not for unclean firstborns, and then, of course, the Exodus 34:20 would be an unclean donkey. Well, I'm not sure what the way to go is, the proper way to deal with this is. I will have to hire a very expensive Jewish rabbi lawyer to figure that one out. The clean firstborn, the sacrificial firstborns, you give them to the Lord and you don't redeem it. Not only do you not redeem it, you actually don't even consecrate it for an offering, for a sacrifice, say for a peace offering or something. No, you don't do that because it belongs to God. It's completely out of your hands. You give it to the priest. That's it. So you don't consecrate it in the sense of offering it up for sacrifice, nor do you redeem it and take it back. Now, verse 27 in Leviticus 27 says this, but if it, the firstborn, I'm assuming it's the firstborn, if it is among the unclean animals, then he shall redeem it according to your valuation and add to one-fifth of it. Now, this brings up somewhat of a technical issue here. We're talking about a redemption of an unclean animal. But the question is it unclean animals in general or is it a firstborn unclean animal? Now, you would think it's firstborn because the immediate verse, 26, is a firstborn among animals. You can't consecrate it. And then verse 27, but if it's among the unclean animals, well, obviously you can't dedicate an unclean animal for sacrifice, so it's a different situation, but it's still talking about firstborn. Unfortunately, the word firstborn is not repeated, and so some people disagree with that. So if it's a firstborn unclean animal, then you've got to value the animal, add a fifth to it, and give the total to the priest if you want to redeem it after you give the firstborn unclean animal to the priest. Now, if the donor does not redeem the firstborn unclean animal, let's say it's a donkey, if he doesn't redeem it, then the priest shall sell the donkey. It shall be sold according to the same valuation that was made in the case of a redemption. And I love how the priests get to value these animals. I guess it depends a lot on their honesty. Now, let's return to the issue that I mentioned here. Does this verse refer to the firstborn of unclean animals, or option number two, does it refer to unclean animals in general? And I said it sounds to me like it's the firstborn of unclean animals. Benson and Ellicott agree with me here. And the fact that it was the firstborn of an unclean animal, we see a distinction between the general rule for unclean animals. The general rule for unclean animals is in Leviticus 27:11-13, which we mentioned in our last audio. Let me read it again. If, however, it is any unclean animal, not firstborn now, but any unclean animal of the kind which men do not present as an offering to the Lord, then he shall place the animal before the priest. The priest shall value it as either good or bad. As you, the priest, value it, so shall it be. But if he should ever wish to redeem it, then he shall add one-fifth to your valuation. So you see, if you give an animal, an unclean animal, to the priesthood, decide you want it back, you can redeem it, but you have to add 20%. That's an unclean animal in general, but the firstborn. Now, our verse here in Leviticus 27:27, I'm assuming it refers to an unclean firstborn. If you want to redeem such an unclean firstborn animal, not an unclean animal in general, but a firstborn animal, you also have to pay 20% and to redeem it. Now, there is an issue as to whether Leviticus 27:27 refers to the firstborn of unclean animals as opposed to unclean animals in general. John Gill says it refers to unclean animals in general, in which case the objection to that would be, well, then why repeat it? Why does the requirement for redemption of an unclean animal in general was already given in Leviticus 27:11-13? You pay 120% of the value of the animal. That's how you redeem it. Same thing here. So what's the difference? I think the difference is, in my opinion, is that Leviticus 27:27 is referring to the firstborn of the unclean animals, not unclean animals in general, but a special type of unclean animal, a firstborn unclean animal. The commentators Benson and Ellicott agree with me on that. The treatment is the same if it's an unclean animal in general or an unclean firstborn animal, 120% value, but the repetition would be just to show that we're now talking about firstborn unclean animals. They're treated the same way as unclean animals in general, and that's why it needed to be repeated. Now, how does Exodus 34:20 refer to this? That also refers to the redemption of firstborn unclean animals. Exodus 34:20 doesn't require the extra 20%, but I'm assuming that's understood because Leviticus 27:27, our verse here, does require it. Now, all of this assumes, I believe, that the firstborn clean animal, the ones that could be offered to the priest, they're not redeemable because the firstborn belongs to the Lord. That's it. It's over. You don't get it back. Text doesn't say so, but I think clean animals are not redeemable as opposed to unclean animals, which are redeemable. Now, there's one way you can say that Leviticus 27:27 refers to unclean animals in general, not firstborn unclean animals. This is John Gill's position. He says that, or Poole comes up with an argument to back him up. He says this is a second redemption. In other words, Exodus 34:20, talking about the redemption of the firstborn, is when you redeem it without your 20%. And now you try here in Leviticus 27:27, after having given it back to the priest, you redeem it a second time. Well, the second time it's going to cost you 20% more to stop your shilly-shallying around. Well, that's clever, but I don't think that's the answer. I believe this is talking about unclean firstborn animals redeemed with 120% of their value. Now, let me return to the issue of reconciling this with Exodus 24:20, where a firstborn unclean donkey could not be valued and redeemed at 20%, but rather a lamb had to be substituted for him. How does that reconcile with Leviticus 27:27, which says that there has to be a valuation and a 20% penalty added, a different way of redemption? Well, I've already mentioned that there are a couple of ways to reconcile this. First, to say that Leviticus 27:27 is for unclean firstborns in general, but Exodus 34:20 is for donkeys only. That's one way to reconcile it, but I don't think that's right, because why? Why make the distinction for donkeys? Second way of reconciling it is Leviticus 27:27 is for unclean animals in general and not for unclean firstborns. The problem with that is that the previous verse, verse 26, is about clean firstborn, so it makes sense when you go to verse 27 that God is talking about unclean firstborns. Well, here's the third way that I didn't mention. This is John Gill's answer. He says that Exodus 34:20 refers to the first time the animal is offered, whether it's a donkey or anybody else or any other unclean animal. The first time you substitute a lamb for it, get your donkey back. But the second time you offer the unclean animal, you have to value the animal plus 20% and buy it back. The idea that's to keep people from offering donkeys and then getting them back with a lamb, offering a donkey, getting them back with a lamb, is to stop that kind of shilly-shallying around. So that's another way you might can reconcile those two passages. Let's go now to Leviticus 27, verse 28. Nevertheless, anything which a man sets apart to the Lord out of all that he has of man or animal or of the fields of his own property shall not be sold or redeemed. Nothing devoted to destruction is most holy, or anything devoted to destruction is most holy to the Lord. Now, this is a strange-sounding verse. This is the New American Standard Bible translation I used. That version says anything which a man sets apart to the Lord. The NIV has devotes to the Lord. I'm going to use the NIV translation to distinguish things. I'm not just talking about consecrating something, setting apart it to the Lord for a sacrifice, which you could then redeem. This is something different because this thing you can't redeem. And in fact, it's referred to even in the NASB translation as something devoted to destruction, which shows this is something extra. This is not your ordinary consecration of a gift to the tabernacle. This thing is most holy to the Lord. The NIV note here for the word devote, anything which a man devotes to the Lord. The NIV note says, quote, the Hebrew term refers to the irrevocable giving over of things or persons to the Lord. Irrevocable, you give it to the temple, you give it to God, or give it to the tabernacle, you give it to God, it's over, you don't get it back. Now, my next question is this, well, if the thing is devoted, can the priest use it? Let's say I devote a sheep, can the priest use it? Or let's say I devote a plow. Can the priest use it, or does it have to be destroyed? Well, destruction sounds, at least in the English translation here, it sounds like the priest can't use it. It has to be totally destroyed. And I'm not dead sure on that. Let me read from a commentary. Unfortunately, I don't have the site here who's saying this, but one of my commentators says this, quote, devoting something was far more serious than dedicating it to sacred use. The devoted thing became totally the Lord's. Achan's sin was the greater because he stole what had been devoted to the Lord. This is in Joshua 7:11. You remember the story. Took some goods that he had expropriated from the enemy and buried it under his tent. And he said everything was supposed to be devoted to God. Well, he stole it. That was bad enough. But he also tried to put to his private use that which was devoted to the Lord's use. Going on with this quotation from my unnamed commentator here, persons devoted to destruction were usually the captives in the wars of Canaan. So that's when a person gets devoted. By the way, the word is kerem, which always means an absolute, unredeemable grant to God, according to Adam Clark. The Holman Christian Study Bible does more than the NASB. Instead of saying sets apart, as the NASB does, the Holman Christian Study Bible says permanently sets apart. So this is a super consecration, if you will. You don't redeem it. It also says this devoted thing shall not be sold. Now, I couldn't find a commentator that said anything on this, so I will give you a couple of options here. Does this refer to the thing being devoted to the priest, and then the priest sell it? And then this is a prohibition against that? Nope, it's got to be destroyed. Got to be burnt up. That would be no selling by the priest after the physical thing was delivered to the tabernacle. Or if there was a verbal promise to deliver the good to the tabernacle, and then the offeror says, no, I think I'll sell this thing instead of giving it to the tabernacle. No, you can't do that. Probably both A and B, both of the above. The priest couldn't sell it or the offeror couldn't sell it. Nor could it be redeemed. That's after, of course, the physical thing had been delivered to the tabernacle and the offeror decided he wanted it back. No, you can't get it back, not even with 20%. It doesn't come back. John Gill says this devoting had a curse added to it as opposed to a mere dedication, which did not have a curse added to it. In other words, a curse if I don't totally just give this thing to God. Achan certainly was cursed by what he did. He shuffled off his mortal coil. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about this. Quote, the devotee accompanying his vow with a solemn imprecation on himself not to fail in accomplishing his declared purpose. Now, I don't know where that's in the Bible. I'm assuming this is Jewish practice that came up later. But the idea is, I am dedicating this thing, this kerem, this holy thing, most holy thing to you. I'm devoting it to you, and may you strike me dead if I don't give it to you totally. May you strike me dead if I try to take it back or try to use it for my own personal gain. So devotion for destruction was serious business. You had no chance of ever getting your animal back. So if you devoted something to the Lord, your animal or your goods, if you devoted it, you're not going to get it back. Now the devoted thing became most holy. That means only the priest could deal with it. He could touch it. He could use the property. He could eat it if it was an animal, if applicable. And I'm assuming that if somebody that was not a priest touched it, he would then become holy, and then he could not touch unclean things. Typically, that's what most holy meant. Someone touched that thing dedicated to devotion. That means he couldn't go back and live a normal, profane, secular life with his family, eating his food, and that sort of thing. Handling a funeral, whatever. We go now to Leviticus 27, verse 29. No one who may have been set apart among men shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. Now again, this is set apart. This is the word devoted. As the NIV says, I'm going to use the word devoted, not just set apart. Set apart doesn't quite do it with me. It's not strong enough. The NIV note here for devote says, quote, the Hebrew term refers to the irrevocable giving over of things or persons to the Lord. Things or persons to the Lord, often by totally destroying them. It's interesting, often by totally destroying them, not always by totally destroying them, but often by totally destroying them. Now, I've already mentioned Achan, but here's another Old Testament example. 1 Samuel 15, Saul sinned in this regard when he didn't totally destroy the Amalekites. They were devoted to the Lord, and they were supposed to be totally destroyed, and they weren't. Remember, Samuel said, what's this sound of sheep I hear? Weren't you supposed to destroy Agag? And you didn't do it. What's this sound of bleeding sheep that I hear? The Holman Christian Study Bible in this verse translates set apart as set apart for destruction. Now, the for destruction is in brackets, which means it's not in the original text, but the Holman Christian Study Bible makes a reasonable translator's inference here that this is talking about devotion, set apart for destruction. Now, there's an important point that commentators make here about this setting apart for destruction. You just don't willy-nilly take somebody like one of your enemies and say, I devote you to destruction, you're going to die. No, you can't do that. It had to be done by a court of law. This was a judicial setting aside for destruction, not a personal setting aside for destruction. Let me give you a quote from Ellicott. Quote, "It is, however, supposed that this awful vow of banning could only be exercised on notorious malefactors and idolaters as dangerous to the faith of the Israelites, that it could not be made by any private individual on his own responsibility, and that when such cases occurred, the community or the Sanhedrin carried out the ban as an act of judicial necessity, thus showing it to be, quote, most holy unto the Lord, unquote. Accordingly, Leviticus 27, verses 28 through 29, treat of two different cases. The former, that's verse 28, regulates objects banned unto the Lord, which differs from the vow of dedication discussed in Leviticus 27, 2 through 8, only insofar that it is unredeemable. We've already talked about that. While Leviticus 27, 29 regulates the banning enacted by the law itself or pronounced by the court of justice on a man who is irretrievably to be put to death. So in other words, we go from verse 28, which is talking about things devoted to the Lord, can't be sold or redeemed. Doesn't really say it's destroyed. That seems to be an interpolation, but it's totally destroyed or permanently set apart. But verse 29, now we're not talking about things, we're talking about people. The law clearly says here. Now that means the person's going to be surely put to death. Now if you're going to be putting somebody to death, that's got to go through the courts. You can't do that privately. Now, it doesn't say that anywhere, but I think that's a reasonable extrapolation. Ellicott believes so. Also, Matthew Poole, let's see what he says. Examples, he gives examples of what might be dedicated to destruction. Quote, "This was unquestionably lawful and a duty in some cases when persons have been devoted to destruction, either by God's sentence as idolaters, Exodus 22:20, Deuteronomy 13:15. The Canaanites were devoted to destruction, Deuteronomy 20:17. The Amalekites were devoted to destruction, Deuteronomy 25:19, and 1 Samuel 15:3-26. Ben-Hadad the Syrian devoted to destruction in 1 Kings 20:42. Or of men who disobeyed God and were devoted to destruction in Numbers 21:2-3 in verses 30, chapter 31, verse 17. Or for any crime of a high nature, as in Judges 21:5 and Joshua 7:15. So there are many, many examples of devotion to destruction, and you'll notice those examples were as a result of judicial activity on the part of either God or the judges. So I think that makes a lot of sense. Now, some people say that poor old Jephthah, remember he devoted his daughter to death. The firstborn who crosses my threshold, I'm going to sacrifice. I'm going to dedicate to the Lord. And so old Jephthah is said to have killed his old eldest daughter. Now, some people say that this verse here gave Jephthah the right to do it. He set his daughter apart for devotion. She shall be put to death. Leviticus 27:29, end of story. Well, if this verse is meant for judicial setting apart to destruction only, then Jephthah had no right to do that to his daughter. Point number one. Now, Matthew Poole makes that point. But point number two, this is D.L. Moody. He's got a book called Difficulties in the Bible. He doesn't believe that Jephthah even sacrificed his daughter, firstborn, that crossed the threshold. He said they kept animals in the houses back then and in the courtyard. And he was talking about an animal that crossed the threshold. He was going to sacrifice that animal or set apart that animal for destruction. We will talk about dear old Jephthah when we get to him once we climb our way out of the Torah. We go now to Leviticus 27, verses 30 through 33. Thus, all the tithe of the land. Now we're switching from firstborns and devotions for destruction. Now we go into the tithe. Verse 30. Thus all the tithe of the land, of the seed of the land, or of the fruit of the tree is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. If therefore a man wishes to redeem part of his tithe, he shall add to it one-fifth of it. For every tenth part of herd or flock, whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. He is not to be concerned whether it is good or bad, nor shall he exchange it, or if he does exchange it, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. It shall not be redeemed. Now the tithe. The tithe is very important, of course. Numbers 18, Deuteronomy 12, Deuteronomy 14, Deuteronomy 26. You can find a lot of stuff on the tithe, and we're not going to talk about the tithe in detail yet until we get over into Deuteronomy. But of course, a tithe and a tenth. Now when it says, thus all the tithe of the land in the New American Standard Bible, it's not talking about tithing the actual land. It's talking about tithing the produce of the land. Holman Christian Study Bible says that actually. They translate that as the tenth of the produce of the land. Leviticus 27:30, and that translation reads, every tenth of the land's produce. That's just to be clear. Now, the examples of produce are given. Seed of the land, anything that's planted with a seed and grows the fruit from a tree. In other words, crops or fruits or products on a tree like a fig, anything. 10% straight off the top, straight to God. It is holy to the Lord. Notice the is there. It is holy to the Lord. This has not happened yet. This is all speaking in advance of their entrance into the Holy Land, and that's how confident God is that they're going to get there. Moses wasn't so confident, given all their sin and stupidity and rebellion, but no, it is holy to the Lord, the tithe of the land, the tithe of the land that they haven't even gotten to yet. It is holy to the Lord. I like that present tense there. Verse 34, if therefore a man wishes to redeem a part of his tithe, now the next question is why would a man want to do that? Well, before we talk about that, let's talk about the tithe in general. I said I didn't want to talk about it too much, so we got to Deuteronomy, so let me just give you a skinny review of it. Israel had either two or three tithes, and that's controverted. Some people say two, some people say three. There's the general tithe, basically what we're talking about here, a tenth of the produce, and that was paid every year to the Levites in Numbers 18:21. To the sons of Levi, behold, I have given all the tithe in Israel for an inheritance, in return for their service, which they performed, the service of the tent of meeting. All right, so the Levites got a tenth, and of course the Levites gave a tenth of their tenth to the priest. Numbers 18:26. Moreover, you shall speak to the Levites and say to them, when you take from the sons of Israel the tithe which I have given you from them for your inheritance, then you shall present an offering from it to the Lord, a tithe of the tithe. And that means present it to the priest. All right, so that's the general first tithe. No controversy on that. Then every year they had an annual sacred meal. Deuteronomy 14:22-27. You shall surely tithe all the produce from what you sow, which comes out of the field every year. You shall eat it in the presence of the Lord your God at the place where he chooses to establish his name, the tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil, and the firstborn of your herd and your flock, so that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. If the distance is so great for you that you're not able to bring the tithe, since the place where the Lord your God chooses to set his name is too far away from you, that's Jerusalem, then you shall exchange it for money. Commute the value, in other words, of the first of the tithe. Commute it to money. Exchange the tithe for money and bind the money in your hand and go to the place, go to Jerusalem. You may spend the money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen, for sheep, for wine, a strong drink. Ooh, strong drink at a party? I wonder what a Baptist would say about that. I hadn't noticed that before. Strong drink? I need to find me a Baptist so I can ask him. Or whatever your heart desires, and there you shall eat in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice. And you shall not neglect the Levite. So anyway, there's an annual party that's given. And again, is that party financed out of the general tithe that's given to the priest? Or is that an extra tithe? I'm going to talk about all this when we get to Deuteronomy. And then there's the poor tithe. That was paid every 3 years to the poor, Deuteronomy 14:28-29. At the end of every third year, you shall bring out all the tithe of your produce in that year and shall deposit it in your town. This is every third year. The Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance among you, and the alien, the orphan, and the widow who are in your town shall come and eat and be satisfied. In other words, the poor, the alien, the orphan, and the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. I've loved to see people who think that the New Testament Christian is under the tithe. Then the next question is, well, how much? Well, the Old Testament, Putin, who knows? I've seen all kind of estimates. I saw a 12% estimate. I saw a 14% estimate. It all depends on how you conflate these three types of tithes that are mentioned in the Old Testament, and it's impossible to come to a consensus. That's the first problem. The second problem is things like, well, do I tithe on the gross or do I tithe on the net? Folks, the New Testament standard is you give cheerfully. That's the New Testament standard. There's no mention of a tithe, not in one place in the Scripture, during the church age. Now, tithes are mentioned before Jesus died when he was still under the law, but we're not under the law. We're in the church age now. The Holy Spirit's falling at Pentecost, and if you want to try to figure out the tithe, get yourself all balled up into some legalistic nonsense, well, then do that. I remember John R. Rice, fundamentalist, who you would think would be under the law by reputation. I read one of his little booklets one time, and he said when he quit teaching the tithe as the storehouse doctrine and all that tithing stuff, he said people started giving to him, and he had more money than you what to do with. You will find that once you start giving joyfully, God will repay you. Pressed down, shaken together in your bosom. You will give him seed for sowing, and then he'll make it grow. But the tithing under the law, no. A tithe is a tax. In the New Testament, it's giving. Giving is never a tax. How many times have you paid your taxes to the IRS, done it cheerfully? A tithe is something that's taken from you, expropriated from you, stolen from you. Well, that might be a little strong, but you know what I mean. It's not something that's given cheerfully. All right, that little rabbit trail on tithing is now finished with. Now we go to verse 31. If therefore a man wishes to redeem part of his tithe, now why would a man want to redeem part of his tithe? Well, before I go into that, let's also bring up another thing about the tithe. People who support the tithe and say that Christians should pay a tithe, they say, well, the tithe was before the law as well as during the law. So if you say we're free from the law, okay, but what about before the law? Remember Abraham in Genesis 14:20 gave tithes to Melchizedek, and of course Abraham was before the law. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. He gave him a tenth of all. And Jacob in Genesis 28:22, this stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, Bethel, this is at Bethel, and of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. So yeah, a tenth was in, but you don't find a tenth in the church age. That's a pattern, admittedly, that's an argument from silence, but the silence is pretty deafening when you consider that finance was a big concern. Paul talked about finances a good bit, but he never mentions a tithe. Seems to me that today in the New Testament church, in the American church, money is talked about entirely too much. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says about the tithe that it was a yearly rent to the Lord, and it was an offering of thanksgiving to him. Quote, it was a yearly rent which the Israelites, as tenants, paid to God, the owner of the land, and a thank offering they rendered to him for the bounties of his providence. Proverbs 3:9 says, honor the Lord from your wealth and from the first of all your produce. All right, so the tithe is established here. Now, I'm going to go to verse 31 and ask the question, why would a tither want to redeem his tithe? Why would he give crops, a tenth of his crops, to the priest and then say, okay, I want them back? That doesn't make any sense, because in order to get them back, he'd have to give the equivalent number of crops plus 20%. So what's that going to get him? Well, here's some options to answer that thorny question. Two options. First option, so he could have the liberty of eating the tithes at home, rather than traveling all the way to Jerusalem to eat the tithe. Now, this assumes the tithe here is the second tithe, the one that's the annual feast, not the general tithe, as John Gill says. Well, the guy says, the tither says, you know, I really don't want to travel all the way to Jerusalem. I'll just take my tithe here. I'll figure out what it's worth. In fact, I'll sell it, and then I'll take 20% from my savings and add 20%, and then I'll send the money on down to Jerusalem by way of messenger, but I'm not going. I'll eat my crops at home. That's one option. That's John Gill's. Here's the second option. When an Israelite didn't have his crops ready in time to pay the tithe when due, he would have to redeem the crops that he owed. In other words, the 20% would be a penalty, a late penalty. He's going to say, yeah, Mr. Priest, I owe the money. I owe the crops, but I don't have the crops in hand yet. I didn't harvest them in time, or something's gone wrong. I've got a problem in my supply chain. I'm going to have to give you the value of my crops, and here's a 20% penalty instead, late penalty. Now, why might the offeror's tithe might not be available? Maybe there was a problem with his sowing and reaping. And that brings up another question, is when was it due? Maybe the priest had a certain time it was due, and they had to give it. Maybe the Israelite had used the tithe improperly for his own purposes, and he didn't have it available to give to the priest. For whatever reason, he could redeem his tithe, but he had to pay 20% to do it. Now, in verse 32, we see that the tithe was of the flocks. Now, we're moving from the tithe of the produce of the land. Now, we're talking about a tithe of the flock. We see that it passed under the rod. Now, what that meant was they had a rod, and they would count off the sheep. And then when it got to the 10th sheep, they say, okay, this one's for God. This one goes to the priest. The rabbi said there was a red mark on that rod that marked the priest so that the priest lamb or priest goats or priest calf would be noticeable. Verse 32 says that animal that was chosen under the rod was holy to the Lord. What does that mean? It means that it could not be used for personal use. It was only used by the priest. What would the priest do with it? Well, he probably killed it. Put the fat on the altar. The fat was always God's portion. Sprinkled the blood in front and then ate the flesh. You know, the law doesn't really say what was done with it, as far as I know. But that's probably what they did do with it. But at any rate, the priest had it. Notice that every tenth animal was chosen whether it was good or bad. The tenth that was given to the priest did not have to be with defect. Now, if it was an animal given for a sacrifice, the animal had to be a male without defect. But here, doesn't say anything about gender either. Doesn't say anything about whether the tenth animal had a defect or not. It just went to the priest. Now, let's say that the offeror looks at the tenth animal and he says, "Oh, that's my favorite sheep. Doggone it. Here, let's just take sheep number 11, this little runt. This little ugly sheep, let's switch him out. Here, priest, I'm going to give you this one instead of number 10. I'm going to give you number 11. Can't do that. If you do that, number 10 and 11 both belong to the priest, and the offerer loses them both. This, of course, was aimed at hindering people from choosing the least valuable animals for a tithe. Now, verse 33 says that the 10th animal could not be redeemed. Remember, we already said produce of the field that was a 10th, they could be redeemed. Why the difference? I couldn't find any commentator to give me some help on this, so this is my speculation. Let's say that you could redeem an animal given for a tenth. You could redeem it, and then you substitute a bad lamb for the good lamb and pay 20% extra, but even with the 20% extra, you come out ahead. I'm a little wary of that explanation because, after all, you're not allowed to substitute another animal. Maybe the "it shall not be redeemed" is just a repetition of the idea you don't substitute a bad animal for a good one. In other words, I want to redeem that good lamb that I gave to you as a tithe priest, so I'm going to give you my bad animal. Well, the substitute's holy plus the original animal. You can't do it. You can't redeem it. No need for 20% there because there's no redemption at all going to be allowed. We finish up now in Leviticus 27, verse 34. Praise the Lord. Hallelujah. "These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel at Mount Sinai." These are the commandments. Is he just talking about chapter 27 commandments or the whole 27 chapters in the whole book of Leviticus? I think he's talking about the whole book. It's not really clear, but I think that's what he's talking about. And he says, "These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses." Now, you know, a lot of people like to say, the Pentateuch, the Torah was not written by Moses. All that JEDP nonsense. Well, let's look at all the scriptures in Leviticus which state that God gave the book to Moses, thus providing strong proof that Moses was the author, Leviticus 1:1. "Then the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting," Leviticus 7:37-38. "This is the law of the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the sin offering, and the guilt offering, and the ordination offering, and the sacrifice of peace offering, which the Lord commanded Moses at Mount Sinai." Leviticus 25:1, "The Lord then spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai." Leviticus 26:46, "These are the statutes and ordinances and laws which the Lord established between himself and the sons of Israel through Moses at Mount Sinai." And there's a lot of other verses too. I'm not going to read them all to you. You go through Leviticus, it's clear that Moses wrote the book, unless you want to say that somebody faked himself being Moses and the whole thing's a fraud. At any rate, we have now finished the very difficult task of examining Leviticus verse by verse. This now leaves us ready to jump into the next chapter, which is the first book of Numbers. I'll start on that in my next audio. I hope you listen to that one. I hope you enjoyed this one.